Whether it's financial security, a free vacation home, time for traveling, more quality time with family, or even early retirement, whatever you choose to do with the income and benefits that come with successfully investing in short-term rentals, you know that it is certainly life-changing. This podcast will help you and guide you and support you on your journey to five-star STR success.
Welcome to Five Star STR Success. My name is Brandon Thompson and I am your host. And today I have a special guest that we're live streaming into my Facebook group, Five Star STR Success. His name is Roger Herring, the investor's accountant, and he is a tax strategist that is anything and everything in real estate. But today we brought him in to talk about short-term rental, of course, because this is a short-term rental podcast. So how are you doing today, Roger?
I am awesome, Brandon. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Thank you. So you are a tax strategist that not only works with short-term rental owners, but you deal with anything and everything short-term rental, right? I mean, real estate.
I deal with anything and everything short-term rental, long-term rental, flip, wholesale, you name it. If it's real estate professional, that's what we do.
Awesome. Well, today we are going to talk about structure, master lease, and cost seg. And I think it's very important. You've actually taught me a lot. I think the 3 years, maybe 4 years I've already been working with you personally, but you've taught me a lot in my own business and how to restructure and to clean up a big mess that I had with my own bookkeeping. He actually told me that he was going to fire me as a client, guys, if I did not get somebody to take over my books. So I had to bring in a professional accountant to run my books, but he helped me clean up a big mess and I'm very forever grateful for it. But let's talk about structure, Roger. Today is a special day because a lot of people are getting into, or this is a special time because a lot of people are getting into short-term rentals for the first time ever, and they're having questions, and they're in my opinion, and short-term rental 3.0 heading into 4.0 before the big entities and REITs start getting in more and more. So people like us who were mom and pops, my wife and I, and other people who have been doing this for a long time beforehand for several years, have some of this experience, but a lot of these people don't. And a lot of people need to understand the right entity structure. So if you were to advise a new client who's just going into short-term rental and they have zero or they have one or two, but they're trying to set up the right structure from there forward, what would you suggest?
Okay. Let me start by saying that structure is the most basic of all the strategies that we teach, but it is also the most screwed up strategy by real estate investors, because they go out and they read something online, but they don't understand truly what the guy is trying to say. So this is very easy. First, we always use a limited liability company. Why? Because if you mess up the structure and it's the first year, most often we can fix it. Okay. Second reason, it has better statutory protection if you're here in Georgia and in some other states as well. It's the most flexible of all the entities, but that's your legal entity, okay? You have a legal entity and you have a tax entity. Now, what tax entity do we want? Our choices are sole proprietorship, partnership, S-corp, or C-corp. And the answer is, we want this either as a sole prop, which is also called a disregarded entity, or if this is a married couple in a state like Georgia that is not a community property state, we want it in a partnership. That's the bottom line. We want pass-through ability for this rental property because it is a rental property. So when you're talking rentals, you always want this thing, any losses to pass through. And when we talk about cost segregation later, if you're set up wrong, you may not be able to benefit from it. So basically that's it. It's simple.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's for protection, it's for pass through. And, you know, like you said, for other benefits that we're going to talk about here in a few minutes, but, yeah. If you're somebody like me, which Roger has helped me clean up a lot. I was just commingling monies from my flips to my rental companies, and I had rental companies in flips, and we're still working hard to separate them because I was doing this for years. And something happened, you know, where somebody would sue me. They could take down all of my rental properties if something happened with one of my flips, as well as if my short-term rentals were completely jacked up. It's just been a nightmare. So what he's talking about here is something you really need to listen to. And since this is a podcast that we're recording live and live streaming into the Facebook group, you guys go ahead and post your questions. And let's just say when we get to here at minute 25 or so, we will answer about 5 to 10 minutes of questions. And then Roger's got to keep on moving. But let's talk about the master lease, Roger. What is the master lease set up, and how would that benefit people who are wanting to rent short terminals as full-time?
Let me give you a little bit of background on the master lease. You know, when short-term rentals came into really being popular a few years ago, everybody's saying, okay, how are these taxed? And there were multiple schools of thought that came into this. One set of the grand high gurus out there said, oh, well, they're just rental properties. There's a fellow named Mark Kohler that a lot of people follow. He's a CPA and a tax attorney. And he lists out that as long as you were not doing daily cleaning on the place, leaving concierge things like wine bottles, welcoming gifts, providing excess supplies, that you're okay. Now, that's one side of the coin. He says rental. The other side of the coin is one of the largest real estate advisory firms in the country, Anderson Advisors. And they say, more often than not, because of the way you operate the short-term rental, it's not a rental at all. It's a hotel. And a hotel means not passive income. It means ordinary income. And then there are people all in the middle. You know, before this, I went up to Airbnb's website and I looked at their 2020 tax guide. They hadn't put the 2021 up yet. Mm-hmm. And it was very wishy-washy, actually, about it. I found it kind of funny. And they were saying that if you did the Airbnb as, quote, essentially a hobby, and that it's just a house that you let out and you're not doing it professionally, then it's a rental. But then they went on to imply that if you are a real estate pro and are operating an Airbnb, that it is indeed a hotel. So what's the answer? Well, I don't like to leave things like this up to Aunt Iris. You know, Aunt Iris, that's our Uncle Sam's evil wife, the IRS.
Right.
So I don't want to leave it up to them, because in an audit recently, they came up with this wonderful idea that providing coffee for a coffee maker was a concierge service, and this was a hotel. So there's a strategy, and this was actually originally developed by Anderson Advisors. It's called the master lease strategy. It's also been called a sandwich lease strategy. Here's how it works, because we're going to give the IRS what they want, but we're going to get something really good that we want. We're going to turn that short-term rental into a long-term rental. Here's how it works. I have a property. I have it in my LLC. Now, what most people are doing right now is they've got that listed on Airbnb and Vrbo, and they're taking the money straight into the LLC, and they're paying for everything out of that LLC. Pretty simple. What we're going to do, though, is we're going to add another entity into this mix. We are going to add a C corporation, and it has to be a C corporation for this to work properly. S corp or an LLC will not work. So what we do is what is referred to as a sandwich lease. And if you're not familiar with that, that's basically Brandon leases a property to me, and I turn around and lease it to somebody else. It's typically an arbitrage play. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I am going to be both the tenant and the landlord, because the C-Corp belongs to me, or me and my wife. Okay, here's what happens. I lease the property to the C-Corporation. The C-Corporation now puts this out on Airbnb and Vrbo. The C Corporation collects the money back from Airbnb and Vrbo, and they pay what the tenant would normally pay, the supplies, the cleaning, the utilities, any general maintenance, not big repairs, general maintenance that you would expect your tenant to pay in any long-term rental situation. And then they turn around and they pay a rent back to my LLC. And as the landlord, I now pay the mortgage, the insurance, the taxes, and any major repairs. On my tax return, it's a long-term rental property because I have a four-month to one-year lease with my C corporation. I like the shorter-term leases because I can change the rent very easily to account for how much money is coming in and how much money I want to strip back out of the C corporation. Okay. Now, if there's any money left in the C corporation at the end of the year, it's going to get taxed at a flat tax rate of 21%. My intent is to pay it all out.
How do you do that?
Or in some cases, if I've got a client that has a very high tax rate and they've sold a bunch of property that year, we might want to leave a goodly bit of money in the C corp because it has a lower tax rate and pay it out next year. Okay. There's ways to do that. But now I have long-term rental treatment. The C corp files its taxes, and it's a hotel. If there's anything in there, they're taxed at the lower rate. The IRS is happy. I'm happy. I have the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. What's some ways when you, like you said, you have shorter term leases to accommodate extracting some of that money. But what if you have a 12-month lease and you didn't want to leave the money in and you have a lot of money left over that you need to extract? How would you do that properly? If, you know, I'm even talking about my own portfolio. If I'm paying out a certain amount every single month and I want to pay myself what's left over, there might be $10,000 on one property, $8,000 on the other, and I want to get that out of the C corp. How would I assess that at the end of the year?
One, you could do a lease addendum. Okay. And increase the rent midterm. Just have that written in that you can do that. But now, you know what? You're both the landlord and the tenant. You can do what you want. Right. Repair assessments are great things. Let's say that you had more than one Airbnb in one little general area. Maybe you had two duplexes that faced each other and there was a parking lot in between. You can charge common area maintenance. There's all kinds of little things you can do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why you're the tax strategist.
How creative can you be as long as it's legit?
Right. So parking or like you said, common space, I mean, anything. So it makes sense. So let me ask you this. I recently called you up and said, don't freak out, people. But I literally like went in a conundrum. I'm like, I'm going all in the short-term rentals last year. I called Roger up and I said, hey, I want to sell off everything. And, you know, I'm going to go buy luxury properties and we're going to buy five or six of them and simplify life instead of having 20 of them, which we have several under construction. We've got 13 on the market right now. Probably in the next 60 days, I'll have all 20 of them on the market, but they're smaller boutique homes. I'm having a blast, but it's a lot of work. And short-term rentals is not passive income, even though you can set it up with an entity structure that Roger's talking about and make it a passive income on paper.
Brandon,
for the IRS.
We all know there's no such thing as passive income. You're going to work your butt off for every single dime of it.
Yeah,
that's just what it's referred to on a tax return as. There is no passive income.
Right, right. I got a friend of mine. I don't know if you know him. His name is Ben, but he's lent me money for several years. And he told me, I asked him, I said, you're extremely wealthy. You're worth $20 million plus. You're lending money to me. How did you get there? He's like, I only know one way. It's grinding and doing it daily for year in and year out. And then over time, you'll be very extremely wealthy. And, you know, I didn't build this thing up passively. And right now I'm still working. And he's a little bit older than me. Actually, he might be my age, but he just had a better successful run. But he says the same thing. There's nothing passive about anything in business. You can just get a high performing job or business and make more money. But at the end of the day, there's nothing that you can really set back and just collect a paycheck unless you maybe invest into a syndication. I know I'm going off topic here, but is that something that you feel is correct?
A lot of, you know, syndication under law is passive income. Now, here's the thing about a syndication though. There's actually normally two LLCs involved. There's the LLCs that's the general partner that is actually operating the syndication. And then there are all the limited partners in the other LLC. Now, they're the investors. A lot of times the general partners are also investors. So they're on both sides of the coin, but they're the ones doing all the work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like one of my clients pointed out, people asked him, what's the difference between a syndication and a fund? Well, a syndication, you invest in one specific property that you've done your due diligence on. You've understood the property. When you're investing in the fund, you're investing in somebody else's ability to pick your property. Mm-hmm. Right. So those two, yeah, they would be passive as an investor, but there's a reason that you have to be an accredited investor to play ball in those parks.
It's risky. You're investing into the founder or the GPs.
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, let me go back to that story. So I called you up maybe a couple of months ago and said, hey, I want to sell off all of my short terminals. We're going to be launching a few more. We'll have 20. It's exhausting. Thankfully, I've got a good team in place, but it still is a lot of work. And I said, I'm going to sell off all of them and I'm going to go get like five luxury properties. And you told me to put the properties into individual LLCs, set up the master lease program like we have already in place. But you also said, or I think I even suggested it to you, I'm going to have probably a $2 million burden or maybe even more, maybe a $3 or $4 million burden off of the $10 million I would walk away with. Sorry, guys, I'm getting candid right now with numbers. Don't sue me. anyways, I said I would actually buy these properties and I would do a cost segregation to wipe out any tax burdens I had. And you thought it was a great idea if I wanted to do that. So can you cover, which I'm not doing this by, well, I may, we'll see. We'll see if I can find the right properties. I found a really nice property in Marco Island, Florida. I got overbid. It's tough market right now, but in a perfect world, if that worked out, it'd been great for me. And I'm going to keep trying, but at the same time, can you explain what cost segregation is, what that entails and how somebody like me could wipe out my whole tax burden, or at least most of it, utilizing kind of the example I was just describing.
Have you joined the 5-Star STR Success Facebook group yet? It's a real estate investing community that focuses on creating wealth and designing your dream life with short-term rentals. There's weekly training, property showcases, money mindset, tools, tips, tricks, resources, and so much more. Head on over to facebook.com/groups/5starSTRsuccess to join, or head on over to 5starSTRsuccess.com, that's the number 5starSTRsuccess.com, and join the community.
Okay. Cost segregation can be your best friend or it can be your worst enemy. Okay. What we do when we do a cost seg is we are front loading the depreciation. Normally, a residential rental property is depreciated over 27 and a half years. But the cost segregation study breaks out the components of the house and the land improvements from your overall purchase. And all these components have a shorter life. And under the code right now, we have this wonderful thing called bonus depreciation at 100%. So anything that we take into cost segregation that is a component or is a land improvement, we can write it off right now. Let me give you an example. We had a property that a client purchased in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It was a cabin. His purchase price was right around $820,000. Cost segregation study was done. Now, obviously, there's a lot of land value stuck in that, but we were able to pull $150,000 up front and totally wipe both partners in this deal, totally wipe their income out for the year.
Nice.
It was nice. Now, they had other properties that we did this with too. Now, there's a few things you need to understand about cost segregation. First, if you're not a real estate professional or you don't have large incomes, don't do it. What is a real estate pro? Real estate pro has nothing to do with having a license. It has everything to do with time. Rule, first thing you got to do, minimum of 750 hours spent in real estate. That's easy. And that's in an owner's capacity, not working for someone else. Second thing, more than half of your for-profit time must be spent in real estate, in an owner's capacity. So if you work a full-time job, that's 2,080 hours a year. you have to have 2,081 in order to be a pro. Now, the first two qualifications, if you're married, one spouse has to qualify outright. You cannot combine times. For the third qualification, though, you can combine the husband and the wife's time. And some of you are going to be out there kind of scratching your head going, but I thought there were only two qualifications. And that's what most people talk about. There's actually a third. And that third one is proving material participation on the properties. What's the most common way? You have what's called an aggregation election that combines all of your rental properties and calls them one business. And now across all of your properties, you, and if you're married, your spouse, have to have at least 500 hours of active participation in it to show material participation. Okay. What do you get for that? You get no limits put on your deductibility. You see, most people can write off up to $25,000 in what we call phantom loss. That means a loss that's created by depreciation. On paper, you cash flow. On paper, you have a loss. You can take that $25,000, you can apply it against your W-2 income or whatever. Until you hit 100 grand, you go into phase out. You're at total phase out at 150. So cost segregation, because of the size of the loss that it creates through depreciation, you have to be a real estate pro, or you're either going to be limited to $25,000, or you may be carrying it forward for a long time until you sell the property if you're over that 100K limit or between the 100 and the 150. So don't be passively trapped.
Right.
So here's the plan, I think, that we laid out. Mm-hmm. You start by selling the properties, and hopefully we can do a 1031 exchange. So we can defer the gains on the properties that you're selling. You acquire the new ones. You get those things completed, and then we do the cost segregation study. Now, we can do one of two things. We can blow away all your flipping and your wholesaling income for the year. We can blow away your wife's commissions for the year. If there's anything left over, it's going to carry forward indefinitely until we can use it. But because Brandon is a real estate pro, he is not limited. The other thing we could do is not do a 1031 and apply all the cost segregation against the gains. Now, you're better off applying cost segregation against ordinary income,
right?
Not against capital gains. It's more effective that way. Now, remember, I said it could be your best friend or it could be your worst enemy.
Okay.
Because that was the molasses. Here's the sulfa. When you do a cost segregation, you change the code section that depreciation is recaptured under. So you're changing your house from real property to whatever you front loaded through the seg is now going to be called personal property. And because it's personal property, it's recaptured as ordinary income. So if you sold that house, you had a huge income for the year, you're in the top tax rate, congratulations, all of that bonus depreciation you took up front is going to be recaptured at 37%. That's not good. And, well, Roger, what if I wanted to do a 1031 exchange? Great. But here's the problem. Everything that you took in the cost seg is not 1031 eligible, and it will be recaptured when you sell it.
Wow. Okay.
So that's the downside.
Okay. It'll be better to do a 1031 and then a cost seg. So that makes sense. Let me ask you this. How long do you need to hold that property? You need to hold it for a while, obviously. What is it, like 6, 7, 8 years?
Yeah, you do. Here's the thing. I tell people, if your intent is to flip your rental, and I've got a lot of people that go in, they set up a rental, they'll hold it for a year and a half, 2 years, and then they'll sell the cotton picking thing. And I'm like, what are you doing? Just selling it outright. Well, yeah, the deal was there. The money was good. Okay. If you're not going to hold it at least 5 years, don't even think cost segregation because of the recapture issue. There's this thing called the time value of money formula. So if you look at this like it's an interest-free loan from Uncle Sam, if you're 5 years or less, you're on the wrong side of the equation. You're actually losing money. Mm-hmm. If you're going to keep it 5 to 7, it depends on the numbers. If you're keeping it at least 7 years, go for it. Go for it. But this is better in a long-term hold, not something you're going to hold for a couple of years and say, bye-bye.
Right.
What's my next property?
Makes complete sense. I think the current administration is trying to do away with 1031s and call segs, or at least kind of phase down the call segregation. Can you kind of fill us in February 22 of what the current administration is trying to accomplish and or if something's already been changed?
Okay. I want everybody to get down on your knees and thank God above for two people, one named Manchin and one named Sinema. The Build Back Better Act that all of these things were in died in December. You know, I spent last year scaring the living daylights out of people with all these things that was in the president's agenda of what's going to happen. And those things you just named them, they were going to scale back your ability to 1031. They were going to eliminate the stepped up basis on inherited property. They were going to limit what you could do with your self-directed IRA. They had all these things. In fact, with self-directed IRAs, they were going to force you to hire a trustee to run it for you. You were no longer going to be able to control your investments. That's how nuts it was.
Right.
Well, this great big fire-breathing dragon was out there just roaring along, and Senators Manchin and Sinema said, time out. We're not doing this. And in November, the dragon got turned into the Geico Gecko. Literally. And there was only like two things left in the bill that would hurt an investor. And then in December, the steamrollers known as Sinema and Manchin ran right over and squashed that sucker flat. It's gone. Now, the problem is when it died, also a lot of tax breaks for lower income folks died with it. The extension of, mega child tax credits that they have, or they call them the enhanced child tax credits. Well, they were planning to restore the state and local income tax floor to $80,000 instead of the $10,000 that's at right now. So there were some things in there the administration really wanted. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to go clear and resurrect this thing. The majority leader in the Senate, Senator Schumer, had promised to vote on some bills by January 31st. Did not happen. So right now, even though they're still negotiating, none of those things that we talked about or and I talked about all last year, none of them are happening. The tax code is pretty much the same this year as it was last year, except for a few things.
That's awesome. Well, so yeah, that. Well, I've been scared, honestly. So I'm glad to hear some of this because I haven't even heard about this yet. So thank you. And then, you know, I promised you in and out in 30 minutes. We got 5 more minutes. We got a couple of questions here, and then I'm going to let you kind of tell everybody where to find you. We have, I think it's Kelly Boughton. She says, I'm selling all my long-term rentals in an effort to convert 2 rentals into short-term rental and to build another one on an existing lot. I am an unmarried sole proprietor. Oh, somebody else put a question in. I'm an unmarried sole proprietor. I manage and I'm responsible for all repairs and et cetera. Should I form an LLC, which I think you already answered this. And also I'm flipping some properties and will profit. And I've had since 2015 and 2016. What are my implications tax wise?
Okay. You've got 2 totally separate tax. Actually, you've got multiple tax issues here. Let's talk about the flips first. Yes, those flips need to be in an LLC, and it needs to be an LLC tax as an S-corp most likely, because there's this nasty little thing called the self-employment tax. And if you just have an LLC and you're a sole proprietor or no LLC, then you're going to get hit with that. So self-employment tax is how Uncle Sam collects Social Security and Medicare for those of us that work for ourselves. And it's 15.3% plus income tax. So if you made $100,000 on it, regardless of what happens, what your deductions are from your itemized deductions or whatever, you're going to pay $15,300 self-employment tax plus the income tax. So getting yourself in an LLC tax is an S. As to the properties, yes, we always want to protect ourselves from our tenants. Now, the LLC is not going to give you one iota of tax benefit. It's like I just said, protect you from your tenants. I would never hold out to the public without a limited liability company protecting me. For these properties that you are selling and you want to move into the rent, the higher end short-term rentals, like I told Brandon a few minutes ago, do a 1031 exchange. Otherwise, you're going to have to give up 15 to 20% of your gain on that back to the government. And oh yeah, that's only the federal side. Depending on which state you live in, you might be paying, like here in Georgia, a flat 6%, or if you were in California, you might be paying another 11% on that. Okay, so do the 1031, form the LLCs, do your flips inside of an LLC taxed as an S corp.
Yep. Sounds about right. That's what he's always taught me, guys. We'll do one more question since we have 2 minutes left. I want to value your time here. Dustin Taylor says, can you discuss any possible short-term rental? Well, hold on, let me start this all over. Can you discuss any possible issues owning a short-term rental but claiming it as a vacation and second home? So he's got one of two questions. And then he says, can Roger take on new clients now for 2021 tax submissions?
Okay. So here's the deal. Why would you want to claim it as a vacation home? Because then, if you're using it and it really is a vacation home, great. Your deductions are prorated and you won't be able to take depreciation in most cases, depending on how often you use it. I would want to avoid using this as a vacation home, but let me share this with you. If you are occupying the home to do maintenance on the home, that does not count against your rental or against your personal use days. So the rules are, the law is, you got 14 days a year or 10% of the days that it was rented that you can use it for personal use, whichever is greater. So if you've rented it for 200 days, you can use it for 20. And that doesn't count time when you were there performing maintenance or repairs, or you're there supervising maintenance or repairs. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, can I take new clients? If you are real estate, absolutely. We only deal with real estate investors, guys, or those that are closely related, like brokers, realtors, private money lenders, that kind of thing. The common denominator is real estate. But if you're in this area, let me tell you about something I've got going on the 11th. If you're here, we're doing a breakfast on the 11th at the 1818 Club in Gwinnett County. That's right next to, I don't even know what it's called now, State Farm Arena. It used to be the Gwinnett Arena. It was the Infinite Energy Center, but I think it's State Farm Arena now. But it's right in the center of Gwinnett. We're going to be doing a half-day seminar, and we're going to be talking about the stuff we talked about today. We're going to talk about structuring. We're going to go a whole lot deeper. We're going to get into the details of 1031 exchanges and the different types of 1031 exchanges. We're going to get into exit strategies, talking about once we're in, how do we get out? We're going to talk about some private lending, and we're going to go over long-term rental, short-term rental, flips, wholesales, everything you need to know. And since I'm such a nice guy, and since Brandon invited me here today, the tickets are $30 off for you guys from now until 4 o'clock this afternoon. And I think you've got the link. I sent it to you earlier.
I do. I'm going to post it in the Facebook group. For those of you that are listening on audio, you'll have to pay full price. This episode will come out this Tuesday, obviously. So you'll be listening to this on a Tuesday, and you'll still have time if you're in the Southeast or in the Atlanta metro area. You want to go to this conference. My wife and I both will be there, so you can come in and attack us and get some face-to-face time with us after Roger's done presenting. I will say this, Roger is awesome. I went to one of his seminars maybe like 4 years ago, and it was pretty incredible. He brings in a couple of good speakers, but just him just teaching on the floor is something that you can't unsee. Just the wisdom behind and the intellect behind him is incredible. But yeah, we're going to set up a separate post for you. I will put that in and plug that for you here after we end this live. Thank you, Roger, for giving the five-star SDR success peers a discount. Where can people find you if they want to reach out or do business with you?
You know, the easiest way to find me is on Facebook, believe it or not. Yeah, you can email me, but I get so many emails a day. Just go friend me on Facebook. If you are in real estate, I see that. I will accept you and send me a message. Brandon and I communicate over Facebook all the time. We do that more than we do email.
Yeah. Yeah. You also have a good, you also have a good YouTube channel. You got some really good videos up there. If people haven't watched it, how can they find your YouTube videos?
All you have to do is go to YouTube and look up The Investor's Accountant.
That is awesome.
The Investor's Accountant, and all the YouTube videos are there. They're free. In fact, there's one up there. I was just pulled it yesterday to send it to a client. What is it? The Master Lease Strategy.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well,
there's
guys,
one on 1031 as well.
Yeah, you have some really good content. I'll also repurpose the Master Lease video into this Facebook group so that you guys who are listening as well as are in the Facebook group now can look at it. So if you're not in the Facebook group and you're hearing this on audio, join the Facebook group. It's in all of the episodes. Well, thank you, Roger. I appreciate you for coming on here.
Hey, my pleasure. Glad to be here.
All right. We'll talk to you later.